Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. And this week on the podcast, we continue with our Meet the Candidates for Governor series. Joining me is Chris Kennedy. He's got an illustrious history. The name Kennedy doesn't even need to be explained in this country or in this state. He, of course, is the son of Bobby Kennedy and has been living in Chicago for many, many years. I want to find out about his policies and plans for the state of Illinois if he becomes governor. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. I want to give my mother a little bit of credit on that. I'm also the son of Ethel Kennedy.
You know, you are. And in fact, your mom is still going strong and was critical in starting the Special Olympics. And, yeah, just an amazing family you come from. So, please, our best to your mom, and no slight intended.
None taken. Thank you.
All right. Hey, look, with the events that have transpired recently in Las Vegas, largest killing in history, given your family history, it makes sense for us to begin with this discussion of violence. It's a federal conversation, but you want to be governor of the state of Illinois. Give me your reaction to the event, and what would you do as governor to address this?
You know, I'd say that the Onion newspaper said it best in many ways, and often humorous. Help clarify our thinking even at the darkest times in our lives. And in a headline, "There's no way to prevent this," said the only nation where this regularly happens. I think at a time like this in our nation's history, we shouldn't look inwardly. We should look outwardly. We should look to other countries, even on other continents, to find solutions to the problems that we face here. The truth is that these sorts of violent crimes are uniquely American in nature. Other countries don't have this going on. And honestly, I think we need to think about what they're doing that's better than what we're doing. We think of ourselves as exceptional, as the best nation in the world, and we are. But we can still learn from others about how to improve ourselves.
And Chris, there's a bit of a difference. You know, as you travel the country, obviously there's the Second Amendment, pro-gun, right to own guns kind of argument. But when you deal with the violence that you would have to deal with as governor in the city of Chicago and the surrounding areas, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, I don't think it's the I have a right to have a gun thing. I think it's the gangs and the drugs. It's that problem that is leading to these violent events.
Well, one really interesting thing about today is that in federal court, a gang member is being sentenced today for robbing what's called a gun train. And that's a train that's crisscrossing the country, stuck in the rail yards of Chicago for an extended period of time, and the gangs regularly hit them. The trains are not well protected, but they're insured. They're insured so that actually it appears as though the trains and the shippers aren't so concerned about the robberies. Unfortunately, the robberies aren't just television sets and, you know, men's suits or ladies' dresses. It's guns sometime. And this gang hit a gun train and distributed hundreds of guns unregistered throughout the gang population in Chicago. I think it's wrong to convict a single gang member for that crime. We ought to prosecute the transshippers, the people who operate those gun trains, who are not providing adequate security in our neighborhoods. And that's going on way too regularly in the city of Chicago to allow it to occur any longer.
You know, your running mate, Rod Joy, obviously a government reform activist, but certainly no stranger to violence himself. And I guess when I first heard about that pick, I thought it was saying to me, correct me if I'm wrong, that violence was kind of the number one issue. Again, your father killed by gunfire, your uncle killed by gunfire, the city situation, and then you pick a running mate who obviously has a name in that area as well. Is that the number one issue? Because I kind of always thought in this state, while that's certainly near the top, this is about budgets and money and the inability to handle it. And would a running mate who was more of a economics guru have been of assistance to you?
Well, the fact is that Rod Joy was one of the great reformers, political reformers, in the state of Illinois, one of the few heroes of this century who's actually gotten legislation passed to improve the challenges that we face to our democracy here in Illinois, where so much power is concentrated in just the hands of a few people. So automatic voter registration will help dislodge that logjam in Springfield. But the point is, though, that these issues are related. Political corruption in many ways leads to gun violence. The fact that we rely on property taxes, a corrupted system in our state, decreases the amount of revenue that's available for local law enforcement. We have something like 1,000 or 2,000 fewer police officers in Chicago than we did 10 years ago. That's largely occurring because the city's under great financial strain that occurs when we don't collect the adequate property taxes from the people who should pay, when the downtown buildings are under-assessed simply because they hire well-connected lawyers and friends of the assessor. So I don't see those two issues living separately, the issues around gun violence, economic development, and political corruption are all intricately linked in our city and in our state.
And so when you look at, let me just take a look at the economics of this for you and many of the other candidates are all for a progressive income tax. You've talked about that on my Politics Tonight show, along with so many other issues. And how do you differentiate yourself from, you know, people want to say, well, it's Kennedy versus Pritzker. Oh, they both have money. Well, it's Kennedy versus Biss. Well, they both want a progressive income tax. Why should listeners who are hearing this, trying to decide if they want a Democrat and they want Bruce Rauner out, why you?
Well, I'd say this. The choice really is between more of the same, people who have been linked to Springfield or have been recruited into this race to protect people like Joe Berrios and Mike Madigan, whose property tax scheme is destroying our state, undereducating our kids, and wrecking our economy. If you want more of that, if you like people who have spent their entire careers in Springfield, then there are choices for you. If you want wealthy people who've been recruited in this race to stop me and this message, well, there's a choice for you. If, on the other hand, you want to change the arc of history in Illinois, rid ourselves of this corruption, bring an equitable system to funding our schools where every kid has a chance and every kid can contribute to the economy of the future, then I hope you'll stick with Kennedy and Joy.
So there may be one wall stronger in life than some wall between us and Mexico, and that would be the Madigan wall. You're pretty tough in your language against him. If you are governor and he looks and says, okay, Mr. Kennedy, I guess we'll be doing battle just as I had to do with Bruce Rauner. I mean, the point is you need to have a relationship with the speaker.
I pride myself as being a Kennedy Democrat. Ted Kennedy Democrat. He's one of the most liberal and progressive members of the United States Senate, but he always had friends in the Republican Party. He could go out on the floor of the Senate and rail against their policies and yet become friendly with them and their families in his off time. I don't think of this as personal, but I think it is professional in a political sense, destroying our state. No other state has results like we do. It doesn't have to be like this. We have 30 high schools in Chicago alone where the average ACT score is a 14 or a 15. 87% of the kids who graduate CPS need remedial education before going on to community college or university. 75% of the kids around the state need that remedial education. That's immoral. Other states don't have results that are as bad as this with a system that's funded exactly like ours. They have better results, and we should adopt those results immediately, those processes, the funding mechanisms immediately in Illinois, so we can improve our results immediately as well.
The governor took a Democrat-oriented stand with the signing of HB 40 on abortion rights. He, of course, lost tons of conservative of support. Did the governor do the right thing there, and does that help him for moderate Republicans who now might feel more comfortable with him?
I think he's looking ahead to the general election. He's becoming more and more political in his thinking. He came in as a disguised as a traditional Republican business person who was going to bring business principles to running government. I don't think that that's the approach that we need, but I could see that it was attractive to people at that time. But he's revealed himself now, not as a traditional businessman and Republican, but as, in fact, a libertarian, someone who doesn't believe in collective action, wants to privatize government and shut down our public universities and schools, privatize them any way he can. I think the decision to protect women's rights to choose was done not because he believes it one way or the other, but because it polled well for him in a general election. And if that's the kind of leadership we want in this state, then he's available as an option. But I just don't think that that's the way we should go.
People hate paying property taxes. The governor actually believes in a permanent property tax freeze and cap. Do you agree with him?
Why would you lock in a system that's corrupt? Why would you lock that system in? Why would you lock in a system where the Sears Tower sells for $1.2 billion and Joe Barrio says, oh, no, it's only worth $579 million? The truth is the governor controls PTAB. He controls the Department of Revenue. He could intervene in these decisions. He sat in the sideline, as he's done with everything else, and has not done anything to fix the problem that is part of his creation. He owns this property tax crisis just like everybody else.
One of your other opponents, Amaya Pawar, alderman of the 47th Ward, he's all for, say, the Amazon deal happening, but he said, you know what, if they can find millions of dollars to make Amazon happen, why don't you match those dollars and improve public housing and improve schools, improve our communities? Don't they, as Alderman Pawar says, let them shut down? Do you agree with Pawar on that approach?
I mean, he's been part of the government for years, and what has he done? We need the Amazon deal to come along to recognize the fact that we have underfunded our housing in the city of Chicago. What's going on here is not a lack of housing. This is strategic gentrification aimed at pushing people of color and poor people out of the city of Chicago. This isn't accidental. This isn't by mistake. This isn't just because we couldn't find the money. It's tactical and strategic. We're pushing the people out of our city by shuttering their local schools, threatening their safety net hospitals, and increasing crime rates by cutting the number of police officers and undertraining the ones that are left. And we have no community policing like we did years ago. And all of those things occurred over the last few years, and they need to end.
You know, one of the rare instances the governor spoke on a social issue as well was when it came to the NFL kerfuffle and the notion of players kneeling. I know you're going to probably support First Amendment rights, but I'm just curious, how do you address people that say our flag must be respected, our national anthem must be respected, and even though the issue might be something else, that's the way they're reading it?
I mean, I'd say this, that, you know, I came from a family that was proud to embrace the notion that we, well, stand for the flag and kneel for the cross. And I think, though, that with these young men, predominantly African-American men, who are raising the question of whether our governments are behaving morally or honorably in conjunction with our religious values, that sometimes I think we need to kneel for the flag in order to stand for the cross and ensure that the Catholic social justice viewpoint that I have, or Abrahamic social justice, which informs most people's decisions in the United States, are respected by our government. So that's the way I look at it.
Education, so critical to you. You talk about it all the time. And it's a funding crisis every year. What would you do to fix it?
It's a crisis because we create it. We preserve a funding mechanism that relies on local property taxes to fund our education. We're never going to have good results. And in fact, we're going to threaten our state, wreck our economy, and doom the next generation to a life of economic servitude. We need to pay for the schools at the state level, like the states with good outcomes do. And the only reason we don't make that switch is because our elected leadership, the head of our party, makes money as a property tax appeals lawyer. And the people in Cook County who control the slating are part of that system. That is, the Cook County assessor is the head of the Democratic Party in Cook County. So even after the Chicago Tribune does a million data point study conducted by the University of Chicago, that experts agree demonstrates a violation of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Almost no politicians speak out. They don't speak out because they're afraid. There's a culture of fear in this state, and it needs to end.
Finally, Chris, you come from a family of politicians, again, presidents and senators and everything else. You waited till almost your mid-50s. You're not quite there yet, I know, to enter the world of politics. Why? Why now? Why not earlier?
Well, I think our state is headed in the wrong direction right now, and I think the governor has failed to lead. And I think that the underfunding of education in our state is driving away the next generation. The millennials understand it. We have the biggest out-migration, the net loss of college freshmen of any state in America. They're sensing what's going on. When I was a kid in high school and college, when we graduated, we moved to where the jobs are. Now the jobs are moving to where the highly educated kids are. And the highly educated kids in our communities realize that there are not enough of them to preserve the economy. If we don't fix the way we fund schools and cast off this group of people who's making money on a system that's damning our state, then we too will be doomed.
Most people expected Chris Kennedy to just walk away with this thing. If forget your skills, the Kennedy name, it's incredible around the country. And people can donate at kennedyforillinois.com. But when you look at the numbers, you'll never match the Pritzker dollars unless, you know, you want to put them in. Concerned about money? Doing all right on money?
I'm not worried about the money. I mean, I operate as a underdog. That's, I think, the best way to run any race. But I think even after $15 or $20 million, I'm still the front runner. And the truth is that, you know, people don't want a billionaire businessman this cycle. They had that in the last cycle. They got people like Mitt Romney, people like Governor Rauner, people like Donald Trump. And that's not what the market wants anymore. Those people have failed to lead in a significant way to improve the lives of others. If people want to be swayed by money, well, there's a candidate that'll help them to do that. If, on the other hand, they want to cast off that group of leaders who recruited JB into this race to protect the racket that they're involved in, well, you ought to come and work with our campaign and make this stop.
People could do that by checking out kennedyforillinois.com. And you know what? Whatever happens in this, Chris, I think it's appropriate to say I extend a thanks to the Kennedy family for all that you have done. I know they're Kennedy fans, not Kennedy fans, but nobody could object that the Kennedy family has given lives and service to this country for probably over 100 years, if not longer. And so I just extend a thanks to the Kennedy clan for all you've done for the country.
I appreciate that, and I'll share it with the members of my family who deserve it.
Please do, and hopefully you'll invite me. I'll come to Christmas dinner. We'll hang around. Thank you. Chris Kennedy, thanks for being with me. KennedyForIllinois.com is the website. Good luck on the campaign trail.
Take care.
You too.
I've always kept to myself. Ain't been given a chance from anybody else. They look through me. I don't see much better. I ain't no hero, ain't brave, ain't all that clever. But what am I holding in my hand? Muzzle and stock, held tight in metal bands, loaded with some small stone or not much bigger. What happens when I aim and pull the trigger? Been alone since 17.
Well, there's some music to introduce you to a wonderful show that's playing over at stage 773. It is called The Civility of Albert Cashier. This show blew me away because it is based in a true story that I never heard about, and it's the story of a soldier during the Civil War from Illinois who was transgendered. And imagine that in terms of today's culture, today's societies, today's issues. And it took the work of the playwright and lead producer, J. Paul Derritani, to sort of uncover this story for us, bring it to the stage with help. Joining me now to talk about this play, a couple of the stars of the play, and Jay is here. And let me introduce you all to them. I guess I'll start with Jay since I've already been talking about you, Jay. J. Paul Derritani he's actually one of the top 100 lawyers in the country. I see his commercials on TV all the time. Always makes me want to call you, but I'm feeling okay, so I don't.
Well, I'm glad you are.
Yeah.
I'm glad you don't need me.
Yeah, I tried tripping other people and hand your card to them. Anyway, we don't want to do that. But anyway.
Don't do that either.
No. Jay, I have a feeling what I've often said about him to you is that he's a lawyer by day, but he is a playwright by passion. And indeed, welcome to the podcast. And this is where you come alive. Am I right? Maybe it's the law, but I have a feeling it's this stuff, Jay.
You know, it's funny, Paul. Well, first of all, thank you for having us on here. It's really a pleasure, especially to be back with WGN. But, you know, both fields mix. It's a lot of my work, as a friend of mine commented the other day, well, I've noticed that all of your writing has a court scene of some sort. So, you know, I usually engage in something that has to do with a controversy or a case that has a trial aspect to it. So, and Albert has that as well.
It does, and we're going to find out about that. But first, let me introduce the two stars who play Albert, young Albert, and I hate saying old Albert because, you know, sorry, Catherine, but we'll start with young Albert. Danny Shea, who is a singer, a songwriter, actor, activist, plays Albert D.J. Cashier in sort of his younger days. And you may know Danny from his appearance in America's Got Talent and the Glee Project, too. And he's just done so many incredible things. Happens to be transgendered, which I have to say because there's some issues I want to talk to you about with that. But Danny, you were on the TV show, and now welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having us. Yes, in the script, we have young Albert and then just Albert so that we don't have to say old Albert.
Oh, so that's good because in the playbill, Catherine, you've been labeled as old Albert. I would go on strike over that, but that's me. Anyway, Catherine.
Well, I would just say elder.
Okay. How about mature?
Mature.
All right. Good. Anyway. Albert, a few years older, is played by Catherine Condon, who actually, what an incredible career you've had. Chess on Broadway, A Chorus Line, the national tour, and you got to play with, like, Donny Osmond in the Joseph show back when he was kind of hot.
That's right.
Yeah.
And he was actually, yes, a hot commodity.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Yeah.
And he is now, too, but those were the loincloth days. I saw that show. And anyway, great stuff. And both of your performances, I asked for both of you to be on because I kind of think you can't get a sense of Albert Cashier without both the younger and older days in him. And so that's why I wanted to talk about it. Danny, let me just come to you. And can you briefly tell us the story? What is The Civility of Albert Cashier all about? And remember, Jay's listening to you describe it, so get it right.
Yeah, right. He's staring me down right now. No. Well, the story goes, in a nutshell, Albert was assigned female at birth, was named Jenny Hodgers by his parents, immigrated from Ireland over to the States when he was young, and both of his parents actually passed away when he was relatively young, and he joined the Union Army at age 19 as Albert D.J. Cashier and lived his entire life during the war and post-war as Albert. Unlike a lot of people who were assigned female at birth and fought in the war, in the Civil War, as quote-unquote men, Albert's story is different because he continued living life as a man, whereas most of the people who were female back then who fought as men in the war lived their lives as women after the war and did the more traditional life that women led. So they, you know, married and had kids and went on to wear dresses and things like that. But Albert did nothing of the sort his entire life. Lived in a small town in Illinois called Sonneman, worked, and, you know, he fought all 4 years of the war and was quite a hero, actually.
Yeah. Not only a hero, but then, of course, as life would have it, gets challenged. And that, Jay, is where your trial scene comes in, or hearing scene, where we deal with a pension because there's a challenge as to whether Albert is indeed a man or a woman. That becomes the focus. So, Catherine, let me come to you. You play Albert later on in life, and you're the one that we see as we kind of go through this hearing. Talk to me about how you kind of relate to this character and just the almost the injustice you see Albert being put through throughout the course of that scene, but also perhaps maybe throughout his life.
Well, I think the hardest thing for anyone to experience is to be told you cannot be who you are. And I think we can all relate to that on some level. And the need to express who you are and live as you would choose is such a large part of, you know, my sense of human rights And it was really painful to delve into how Albert was treated and abused when he was much older. And he was in an accident that sort of put him in a position of being in a hospital, and he was also experiencing some dementia at the time. And, of course, society was not kind to him in that particular position. And then his gender came into question, and that's how the pension hearing came to be. But it's quite a journey, and the telling of the story, I think, is really critical, especially in the political climate today.
Yeah, and Jay, two questions for you. Number one, first of all, why a musical? Because obviously there's drama all over this thing, so it could have just been done as a straight dramatic work. You chose to make it a musical. And then secondly, as you present all of this, these conflicts on stage, I'm just curious for you, how much of it is real? How much poetic license did you take to, you know, create a story that, because real life is never as interesting maybe as what we see on stage. So how close to real life is it? But first, why a musical?
Well, I have to give some credit to the director and to the composer, Joe Stevens. When I first, and who? And Keaton, yeah, I said the director Keaton and Joe Stevens. I'm sorry, I'm getting corrected by Danny here.
Hey, you chose to be in the same room. That's up to you.
So anyway, I had originally wrote this as a play about 3 years ago and was playing with it, and then Keaton had talked to me and read it, and he asked me, "What can I write the music for it, or help write the music for it?" And I said, "Well, let's try to get another composer involved," and we did. And we found Joe Stevens, an amazing artist, also a trans individual, who's played with the Indigo Girls and other bands. And I actually have his music on my iPod, and I use it to go running with. And he really helped. I got to give a lot of credit to them. They really helped put the music together. I helped write the lyrics. They certainly did the composition of the musical pieces, though. And that's what we did.
And then how true to life? I mean, you had to take some liberty here, right?
What was real and what wasn't. I tried to keep as much as I could of the story, of Albert's story, intact. It was really important to me as a writer because his story is good enough and it's dramatic enough without embellishing it too much. I thought that Albert's story had such pain just in terms of how his life ended and the way he was treated, which Catherine just plays so brilliantly. And then the heroism that's played by Danny so brilliantly, that I didn't have to do a lot. It was an easy piece to write. There's certain things that we did do, like when the soldiers came back and testified for him, it was actually in an affidavit form, a written form, and they sent it in. And I don't think a written form would play as well to in front of an audience, so we had them actually appear on the set. But all of the soldiers' names are actually names from the 95th. They are people who we don't want to forget because they gave quite a sacrifice to our country. And most of there's some embellishment. The love interest of Albert is named Jeff N. Davis, and that's made up, a little bit of artistic liberty, but
okay.
I think that helps push the story forward.
Yeah, well, and Danny, I want to talk to you. Teach folks a little bit of something here, if we can, because you are transgender, and I don't know how relevant that was to even casting you in the role, because it wasn't all that well. I guess Jay can tell us whether it is, but I want to talk to you because there's a couple of lines in the show that really hit home with me, and they are: "I'd rather die for the truth than live a lie, and we can say we're better, but we know we're not." These days, I think there's a lot more understanding in our culture for transgendered people. Can you talk a little bit about what it means to be transgendered? And I got to have you clear something else up. I think people get so confused in the pronouns that they should use to reference somebody. And I ask that question out of respect and out of a desire to get it right. So could you address some of that for the listeners?
Sure. Well, you know, the conversation is thankfully expanding these days and becoming more and more a part of a mainstream conversation, so that's great. And as far as pronouns go, it's something that I think, you know, we trans folks have to be patient about because we are asking people to, in a sense, have a little bit more, like to not just go on default, but to instead pay more attention and to actually ask. You know, never before up until recent years were people asking the question, hey, what are your pronouns? And now that is a reasonable question that you can ask someone who, especially if it's someone that you're not really sure how they would like to be referenced.
So it's an appropriate question.
An appropriate question. You can say, what are your pronouns or what pronouns do you prefer? And that person can answer and say, oh, I prefer they, or I prefer he, or I prefer she, or I don't have a preference. And there are other pronouns that exist as well, like Z and here and things like that, that are, I think we're trying to address this situation where the U.S., especially in the English language particularly, we have such a binary approach to our language. It's he or she, and there's an in-between world of gender expression that exists. I'm an example of that, being a non-binary trans person. I fall somewhere either in the middle of the spectrum or, you know, like somewhere in between the two poles of binary male-female expression. But I also, the other idea about being agender or non-gender or non-binary or genderqueer is that you can be outside of the binary altogether and feel genderless, like you don't relate to having a gender.
By the way,
I personally am trans masculine, and I prefer the pronouns he and they. They is appropriate if he is too difficult for someone for whatever reason.
Ah, okay.
I'm okay with that. But
can I ask?
Really,
I know you.
It's just that
you, I have to
we
ask
have
you
to realize that gender is not just. It's not about what our anatomical makeup is. It's not what just our body, or what's between our legs, for lack of a better way to describe it. It's also what's in our heart, and it's that is what makes up who we are, is what's inside us. And I think that if we can learn to start asking these questions and talking to one another and getting to know the way that we actually feel rather than jumping to conclusions based on what we think, that's really what will help us to just find our way through this. I mean, it is a relatively new conversation.
Yeah.
I mean, Delia Kropp, who plays the nurse, is a brilliant trans actress, and she's getting to play a cisgender female for the first time on stage in her role as nurse as the nurse. And she was telling me that, you know, up until pretty recently, the words that were used were transvestite or transsexual, and transgender is a nice umbrella term that can incorporate all gender nonconforming people. So to address your favorite quotes or some of the favorite quotes that you listed off, the first one you said, I'd rather,
I'd rather die for the truth than live a lie. That's your line.
That's one that
it's my line.
That's your. I mean, it's Catherine's line, but it's in the show.
Catherine,
yeah.
Catherine says, "As old Albert," and it always resonated with me too, because that's the way I feel. You know, that is the way that I feel. It's growing up and feeling like I was always told to be a certain way and conform to certain rules about what it is to be a girl and a female. It never sat right with me because it just didn't. That's not how I felt. And I would ask my parents certain questions, and I'm certain I made them uncomfortable a number of times with my questions about it. But I think that's important. It's important to be uncomfortable sometimes, because that is where, and that's where growth lies. That's where how we can actually expand. And the other one is
we can say we're better, but we know we're not.
Yeah, that line always hits me too, because it comes at a time, it's a very pivotal moment in the play where a lot of young Albert's friends in the union are dying right in front of him, and he's realizing how barbaric war really is, and he's realizing that this thing that all these young men and young people were excited to be a part of, he's wondering, like, wait, this isn't this isn't civil. Why are we doing this? And, you know, on both sides of this, even in today's world, this, you know, Democrat, Republican, yada, 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 Confederates and Union, we on both sides, people think they're right and people think they're better, but we're acting insane, killing each other and blowing each other up, and instead of finding a way to actually discuss these things and find a civil way to discover solutions, you know. So I think that's really a key point in this, in the play, is because that's where Albert starts to realize there's a much, much bigger picture here.
Thank you for sharing all that. I really appreciate that and your candor. Catherine, you know, the other thing, even though there's the transgendered message that comes from the show, but, you know, there's so much more. There's an African-American surgeon in the show, and the assumption being made at one point, well, you must have been a slave, because you're black, so you must have been a slave. I mean, it's probably a better question for Jay, but I just want to come to you. As you read this script for the first time and started seeing these stereotypes and these whatever, did this show take on a bigger meaning than just having a story to tell?
Oh, well, of course. You know, I think that all stories are a reflection of us as human beings and the society in which we live and the history that has been written, which, you know, isn't always the full truth. So, I think that stereotypes, you know, happen for a reason, and it's important to confront the stereotypes and to make them personal and human and have souls, so that we can, you know, expand the discussion about who we are as human beings and what's important in the world. Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. That's a testament to Jay's wonderful writing.
And Jay, you know, Jay, obviously, Washington is, you know, looking to cut funding to the arts. I mean, we kind of go through this every time there's changes of certain kinds of administrations, and they don't seem to care about that. So for people who do say, you know what, there's people starving, there's people trying to get through hurricanes, there's all this other stuff going on, the arts is not really a top priority. What do you say to them?
I certainly agree that we have to fund other programs first. It's not a question of a competition, though. We have enough money if we spend our money correctly. And I think instead of giving corporate tax cuts to, you know, very, very wealthy individuals, that's my personal opinion, I think we all benefit, all of society benefits from the arts. Also, if you have more funding for the arts, you have less people going to prison. They've done studies on this. That you expose people to arts and literature and culture, and I think it has a profound effect on their learning. So it isn't a competition, and we don't have to compete the arts versus homelessness or things like that. Of course, I would say feed people first, but it's not really a competition. And what little money is granted to the arts through the NEA and so forth is so minuscule compared to what we're spending on our military-industrial complex. Hmm. That it's not even an argument that bears any sense, in my opinion.
Danny, and I think we all have friends. I certainly have a couple of friends who are well-known trans actors, and life was different years ago than it is now for some of them. I think it's a little bit easier and more free right now. You see that in different shows on the air. But I want to ask you, you don't live in Chicago, but you have been for this show. Has this been a welcoming city?
Yes, it has. I'd say that's just it, is that there are certain parts of the world and certain parts of the country that are more accepting than others. It's easier for us in Chicago and Los Angeles and New York, where, you know, it's just more liberal in general and more open in terms of all of that. But, yes, Chicago's been lovely. I really enjoy it here.
And Catherine, you've been on the stage all over the country. I just want to get your sense. Chicago audiences, I've always thought they were among the best, because even though people look at New York, I'm going, they're tourists. Chicago, with all due respect to New York, Chicago, we kind of know our theater here, don't you think?
Absolutely. This is one of the best places to do any kind of new work or anything that's progressive or out-of-the-box thinking. And you have such talent here in every aspect of the arts. It is remarkable, and it's a great place either to cut your teeth as a young actor or to do what I do as somebody who's been in the business their whole life. It is exciting, and it's always some of the best work that I've ever experienced anywhere.
Danny, while I have you, Can you talk a little bit about Be More Heroic, your non-for-profit organization? Obviously, you're making a difference in this life. That's what you're about. So I don't want to, you know, we're looking at this performance, and it's wonderful, but you're doing bigger things with your life.
Well, this is definitely a really big and meaningful project that I think can make a huge difference in the world, which is one of the reasons I was so drawn to it. Be More Heroic is an organization that I co-founded with some friends of mine. Basically, we've done a lot of school assemblies where we go into high schools, middle schools, and even some colleges, and we've even done a summer camp where basically we bring the arts in, and we use that as a platform to convey deeper messages to young people and to help cultivate more confidence and tools for them to use creativity as a way of getting to know themselves and having more compassion for other people. So we were sharing stories of our own struggles being young people, dealing with gender or racial issues or self-confidence issues or abuse, lots of different topics that we covered. But right now, the organization is putting most of its focus on this documentary that we are producing. It's going to be released soon. I have to find out actually the exact date for that. Okay. But keep an eye out for that. Thank you for asking about it, too.
Yeah, well, and come back and talk about that when the time comes. And Jay, I'm just curious, in the casting of Danny and Catherine, but did you, when you wrote this, did you have those folks in mind? Did you, did you say, I'm going to reach out to Danny and just see how this works? I mean, because it kind of looks like a good hit you made there.
Oh, well, I also got to give credit to our wonderful casting director, Robert Ulrich, from L.A. We knew that we wanted to have at least one trans individual in the show, because I think it's very important that a trans story and I always say it's not just a trans story. I think it's a woman's rights story. It's a story about PTSD. It's a story that appeals to the civil rights and even people who love history and people who want to enjoy music. But from a trans perspective, I think it was important to have at least one individual help tell the story who is trans. And it's important that we have voices. You know, we have a lot of people in different shows that play gay individuals, and yet they're not gay. And I like to try to think that we should give those individuals, if they have great talent, the LGBT community, those roles if we can. And Danny, within 10 seconds of meeting him, I was convinced not only by his amazing voice and his acting skill, but his smile and his charisma and his ability to carry an audience. And we've had, Paul, a standing ovation every single night of our performance. So it's been tremendous. And without a doubt is because of Catherine and Danny and really this whole cast.
Yeah, and I think I led the standing ovation the night I was there, which was opening night. It was just an amazing show. The other day, by the way, I was walking by the theater, and I just happened to pass a friend of mine who's now a retired law professor, hadn't seen him in a long time. And I said, oh, where are you coming from? And he said, I just went to see this show, Albert Kishir. I said, what did you think? He was blown away by it, just blown away. And I say that because this is a show that young people will relate to in a certain way. Older individuals relate to in a way. It actually has a message, I think, for everybody, and I think it's got a message that needs to be told. I don't think any of you will disagree with me on that.
One interesting little tidbit is we had a big bus group from Bloomington Normal. So it's out there in the suburbs or the suburbs of Bloomington Normal. A lot of farmers and actually the mayor of Sonneman and folks like that. And I was wondering what the reaction was going to be. And they were in tears afterwards. And they actually gave, I think, one of the best reactions of any crowd we've had. And one after another, and they were probably Republicans or different folks, different backgrounds, older folks, and all of them kept saying, this story needs to be told. This story needs to be told. We hope you take it further. And that was, to me, the best compliment.
I agree. And it not only needs to be told, it is being told, and it's being told right here in the home of where it happened, which is our own state. You got to get tickets for it. It's playing till October 22nd, and so that doesn't give you too much time to see it. But the Civility of Albert Kishir at Stage 773, you can get tickets. It's easy enough. You go to stage773.com to get tickets, right? I got that right, stage773.com. You can also learn more about the show itself and about Danny and all these people, Catherine, everybody at Albert Kishir, the musical. Chicagoreport.com. I congratulate all of you. And Danny, I hope you'll kind of see Chicago as maybe a new home for you. And, mm-hmm. and Catherine, don't you go anywhere either.
I won't.
All right, hang around. And Jay Paul, make sure you don't go anywhere because we need
except
you.
Except for January, I'm always here.
All right. Gee,
well,
I can't
thank
imagine.
You so much for having us on and having this enlightened conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you to all you guys. Again, the civility of Albert Keshier at Stage 773, stage773.com. Thanks, everybody.
Bye bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes and tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.